Hi, I'm Ben Wallace.
And I'm Michael Long.
And we are Goodness Over God. Well, today is the Easter episode. It's Saturday. It's the day before Easter. So for Easter, what we're going to do is talk primarily about the supposed evidence for the resurrection of Jesus, and in particular, how it is that we do history. And to kick all this off, I wanted to say something about... it so happens, you see, that I've done a read-through of Mark, of the Gospel of Mark, in the days leading up to Easter. And one of the first things I noticed about it was it's strikingly different and, in my mind, contradictory portrayal of Jesus as opposed to the other Gospels, in particular the Gospel of John. I just wanted to say something about the issue of secrecy in particular. This is one of the most interesting examples, in my opinion, of the differences between Mark and John. In the Gospel of Mark, Jesus is portrayed as the Messiah. In the Gospel of John, of course, he's portrayed as the Messiah, but also the God himself. He is God made flesh. It's in Mark that we see Jesus' identity is kept secret. When he talks to other people in the Gospel of Mark, he says flat out, Mark chapter 8, verses 11 to 12, I will not give a sign. This is what Jesus says in the Gospel of Mark. But in the Gospel of John, Jesus does nothing but give signs. In fact, at one point in the Gospel of John, chapter 12, verse 37, Jesus says that he performed many signs before the unbelievers. The signs that he performs in John are different than the miracles that he does in Mark. In Mark, Jesus is helping people. He's driving out demons, he's healing people, he's feeding people. And when he does it, when he casts out demons, for instance, in Mark chapter 1, verse 34, he doesn't let the demons speak. Why? Because the demons know who he is, and he doesn't want them to give away his secret. But in John, the miracles of Jesus are things like turning water into wine. And in John chapter 2, verse 11, we hear why he's doing these things. It's to manifest his glory. It's to show who he is. In Mark, he takes his 12 disciples aside for a moment, and he tells them, to you I'm giving the mysteries of the kingdom of God, but to the other people, I'm only going to talk in parables. And he gives a reason. He actually says why he's only going to talk in parables to the outsiders. It's because he doesn't want them to understand. This is Mark chapter 4, verses 10 to 12, by the way. In the Gospel of John, Jesus can't stop talking about who he is. At one point, the Jews are talking to him, and he says, before Abraham was, I am. This is, of course, a reference to what God told Moses. Tell them that I am sent you in the Old Testament. At one point in the Gospel of John, Jesus says, I and the Father are one. Jesus can't stop talking about who he is in the Gospel of John. In Mark, it's a big secret. In John, it's something that he wants to tell everyone. And this is one of the striking differences between Mark and John. So after I noticed these differences between the Gospel of Mark and the Gospel of John, I was again reminded of the fact that the historical reliability of these Gospels is an important and really indispensable assumption of apologists when they build their case, their so-called historical secular case, for the resurrection of Jesus. For example, the apologists Timothy and Lydia McGrew in the Blackwell Companion to Natural Theology, they have a long article devoted to this where they assume that the Gospels are historically reliable, in fact, that they are written by either eyewitnesses or people who knew eyewitnesses. But that's just an enormous assumption that I don't think we have any right to make.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me, there, and there's a lot to talk about here, but it strikes me that not only is Jesus secretive in Mark, but But at the end of Mark, you know, if you cut away, and I unfortunately don't know off the top of my head, how many verses it was. But if you cut off the very end of Mark, which doesn't appear in our more reliable manuscripts, you pretty much have the women just leaving the tomb and telling no one. And it's, you know, which is, again, consistent with that notion that, you know, in Mark's our earliest gospel, it's consistent with that notion that the notion that nobody really understood Jesus the way we understand Jesus today. Nobody understood him to be as public as he was. It's as if the theology surrounding Jesus became later. So, you know, and that's why you have him going and telling people, don't tell anyone that I healed you. Go and, you know, don't speak of this to anyone. You know, it's pretty convenient to go and have him be secretive in that way, you know. So you can say later on, well, he was doing all this, and he was claiming to be the Messiah, and so on. But so much of his ministry was on the down low, you know, and that's why maybe you weren't aware of a good deal of this until now, even though in fact it was invented later.
That's an interesting possibility, and it's. It's so hard to look at these Gospels 2,000 years later and try to say what could have been motivating their accounts. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to say what exactly is historical and what's not.
Mm-hmm.
I know that a lot of really radical skeptics are ready to just throw out the Gospels altogether. They are just riddled, in the opinion of these skeptics, they're just... Mm-hmm. Riddled with problems, just they're hopeless, and we've just got to throw them out. I don't think that I'm quite that far gone, but I am. It's troubling to see apologists go in what I would consider to be the exact opposite extreme. They are ready to swallow these stories whole, and I don't think that they realize it. For example, when we read the Mikru's piece in Blackwell, they say we're not assuming inspiration, much less inerrancy. And I suppose that they're right. They don't assume inspiration in their arguments, at least. But boy, they're ready to assume a great deal else.
They certainly are. Yeah. They're willing to countenance miracles. Paranormal events, things that defy our understanding of the way the world works. And of course, you know, they're quick to say, apologists in general are quick to say, well, you know, if you're going to go and criticize the Gospels and say that they aren't historically reliable just because they have paranormal events in them, well, you're arguing in a circle that, you know, you're just assuming that naturalism is true and that there is no God, or at least that there are no paranormal events, that God doesn't intervene in the world. To that I would say, first of all, as a historian, you know, you have no business considering the paranormal. You have to act upon our best understanding of the way the world works right now if you're going to make any judgments about what happened in the past. And which we can get into, the reasoning there. But there's nothing circular about it. I don't look to history, and I don't think anyone should look to history to, you know, confirm paranormal phenomenon. By paranormal, I mean events that are inconsistent with our best understanding of the way the world works. And you know, as soon as the apologist makes that move, as soon as the apologist looks at miraculous events and says, okay, well, this is something we're going to take seriously. This doesn't count against the historicity of whatever document we have. Well, then nothing could possibly count against the historicity of whatever document we're considering.
The way I look at it is we observe a certain way that the world behaves. In other words, we observe regularities of the world. This is the whole point of talking about laws of nature. Laws of nature are these observed regularities that we infer hold either most or all of the time.
Mm-hmm.
If if we don't have regularities, if we can't infer that regularities that hold now in our present experience also extend into the past, we have no way to do history. The only way to draw historical conclusions is to count on those regularities. If we give them up, well, that's not necessarily a cardinal sin, but if we give them up, we can no longer do history. We can no longer say what happened in the past.
Yeah, and the point there isn't to say that things had to happen in the past the way they happen now. It's just that we've taken away our tool, an important tool, crucial tool for doing history, if you go and you say that they didn't happen the same way in the past as they happen now. I mean, if you think about it, any purported historical evidence is only evidence, against the background of some theory. I mean, all we have to infer things about the past are things that exist in the present. If I come home one day and I find that my window frame has, instead of a nice plane of glass in it, it just has shards of glass sticking out of the edge, out of the edges. And on the floor, there are other shards of glass and a baseball sitting there. Well, you know, I would naturally infer that somebody went and hit a baseball and it struck my window, shattered my window, that the glass on the floor is from my window, and the baseball had been previously, you know, sailing through the air, you know, and striking my window. But think about, you know, and so here I have present evidence. I have a baseball on the floor, and I have shards of glass on the floor. But think about all the background theory that had to go into my inference from this present evidence to historical events, you know, things that happened that I wasn't there to observe. It has nothing to do with my memory. It's just but it's something that I'm supposing did happen in the past. I have to suppose that planes of glass can shatter. I have to suppose that baseballs sometimes aren't on the ground, but sometimes they're flying through the air, that when they strike planes of glass, they can shatter those planes of glass, that when a plane of glass is struck, it will produce shards. You know, it'll separate into shards, much like the shards that I have on the floor around the baseball. I have to dismiss other possibilities, like perhaps it's the case that, baseballs just occasionally appear on floors, and they're always accompanied by shards of glass. and that in fact that happened, and then it just so happened that there are fairies that often are interested in those baseballs, and they like to go and steal coal planes of glass that are nearby such baseballs and replace them with little shards of glass. You know, we could make up stories like that all day long. I dismiss though such stories because, again, it's inconsistent with my experience with how the world works. Any historian only has just stuff, meaningless stuff, if they don't have a theory with which to interpret it. If you have bits of parchment, if you have the stories of people who are witnesses, or people who have read parchment, or if you have things that, pottery that you've dug up, or whatever current evidence you have, in whatever form it takes, you can only suppose that it tells you particular things about the past if you have a theory against which to interpret it. And the question is, okay, what kind of theory, what sort of model should we use to make our inferences? Now, we needn't use the model that we gain from our actual experience with the world right now, the way the regularities of the world as we've observed them, but if we aren't going to use that model, on what basis do we pick a model? I submit that it's completely arbitrary to suppose that that Jesus rose from the dead, as opposed to supposing that the psychology of any actual purported witnesses, assuming we even have good evidence to think that there were witnesses to a risen Jesus, evidence that could be credibly construed in that way. Even if we had such evidence, I would say, well, why not suppose that they were just psychologically manipulated by, say, a wizard or something? You know, after all, we have good reason to believe in wizards. We have reasons to believe in wizards, whether they're good or not. That's kind of what's the question. You know, in the Old Testament, we know that there are wizards who weren't working for God, incidentally, who, you know, cast their staves to the ground and they became snakes. We have wizards throughout all cultures who cause all kinds of trouble, including, you know, and a lot of the trouble that they seem to cause seems to be psychological. You know, apparently that's an easy sort of wizardry, you know, to go and cause people to become impotent, to cause them to see things while they're sleeping, because, you know, that's much more common than anything that produces hard physical evidence. So it seems that, you know, given our background of, you know, knowledge of wizardry, if we were to go and just allow for paranormal explanations, well, the wizard example is at least, the wizard theory is at least as credible as the creator of the universe raising Jesus from the dead. You know, and if you don't want to go with them, even if you want to say that Jesus was risen from the dead, you know, you certainly shouldn't assume it was the creator of the universe that did it. This is another thing I object to in this paper on page 594.
Now they, wait a second, though.
Okay.
Before you go there.
Yeah, all right.
I can only imagine what our Christian listeners are thinking about this wizard hypothesis. Because you have to admit, the idea of a wizard being responsible for psychologically manipulating the what is your story, that they psychologically manipulated the authors of the Gospels or the original apostles who inspired
whatever witnesses they needed to manipulate?
Okay, you know. so they're psychologically manipulating some group of people. I don't know, this seems far-fetched. It seems intuitively, I should say, it seems far-fetched. No matter what evidence you can marshal for the existence of wizards throughout history, surely the resurrection hypothesis, these apologists would probably say, is better than this wizard hypothesis. After all, we have people claiming that the resurrection occurred, and we have all kinds of witnesses for the appearances of Jesus and what have you. I don't think that they would just let you slide by with that. They're gonna press that point. Yes, the resurrection is a better hypothesis than the wizard hypothesis.
I would suggest that they don't understand what happens when somebody dies and is dead for 36 hours or so. I mean, you know, when your cells fall apart, I mean, that's what happens. They become consumed by their own enzymes. Any neural connections that would have been in Jesus' brain would have been utterly destroyed. The destruction of information in a dead body is so profound. Why, you know, why dismiss that? I mean, it's not as if coming back from the dead were merely some kind of cosmetic, you know, change, some minor thing. It is much less reasonable to suppose that somebody, you know, came back from the dead than to suppose that, you know, frankly, that a bunch of people, you know, putting wizards aside, that a bunch of people lied and had some kind of an incredible conspiracy, or that they just were all happened to be deluded in a similar way at the same time.
Well, I think they would grant the point that it's less intrinsically probable. You see this a lot in the literature. You see this in the McCrews paper, for instance, where they talk about how certain hypotheses are intrinsically, quote-unquote, improbable. But what the apologist wants to do is to say, look, even though it's intrinsically more improbable, given the information that we have, given the evidence that we have, the witnesses and so forth, this makes it more probable once you take all that into account.
Well, how do witnesses help? I mean, the whole point is that the evidence that you have are witnesses. The question is, how do we explain the, or at least purported witnesses? How do we explain our current evidence for purported witnesses in the past? You know, why do an actual resurrection? Why not go and imagine any other arbitrary paranormal or preferably non-paranormal hypothesis that we could come up with? You know, again, we shouldn't go and posit wizards, of course. We should posit some kind, I mean, unless we just reserve judgment, we should go and think about the things that don't violate our understanding of the world, things like conspiracies, lies, delusions,
sure,
even if they're improbable, you know?
No, and I certainly agree with that. We, I hope that people aren't thinking that we believe in wizards. You know, this is
oh,
the
sure,
uncharitable
yeah.
vision of counter-apologetics that some Christians have. But you make, in my opinion, a great point, which is that... And here's... Actually, let me put it my own way and see if that maybe helps. Seems to me that the apologist wants to say that, yes, we do need to rely on regularities, but none of our stories, none of our naturalistic accounts for the evidence, in other words, none of the explanations for the evidence which follow the rules that we set up through those regularities is going to cut it. The only one that does is the resurrection hypothesis. And yeah, that does do away with, they might want to call it one particular regularity, which is that people don't rise from the dead. But one of the regularities has to go, and I think that they'd say that's the one that's most plausible, since we have all this evidence for it. Of course, the problem is, again, the evidence is only evidence against the backdrop of those regularities. And if we're going to do away with some subset of those regularities, how can we possibly decide which regularities we're going to jettison? And I think that this is the point you're trying to make, I think, which is that, well, instead of jettisoning the people don't rise from the dead regularity, we can jettison the wizards don't psychologically manipulate people regularity. Why That's prefer right. one jettison over another?
Exactly. That's exactly the point. If you're going to go with a paranormal explanation, then the gloves are off. We can go and posit any silly thing we like. You know, it's because, you know, we're supposing that the world worked differently in the past. Well, who's to say how it worked differently in the past? You know, you've removed any model that we would have that we know inductively, that we have reason to believe in for inductive reasons. And, you know, we throw away our experience with the way the world works, and we suppose that things were different somehow in the past. And naturally, people want to go, you know, I think the problem is that because we've been raised in a Christian culture, because we've, or in a theistic culture, you know, broadly speaking, we're inclined to take certain stories, certain myths, more seriously than others. We're going to try to interpret weird things at whatever level, be it us or, you know, purported eyewitnesses. You know, we're going to tend to interpret things in terms of the kinds of stories that we were raised with, you know, that we learned on our mother's knee. And we know that that's a mistake, you know, if we just look at other cultures, other people who fall into the same trap. I always like to bring up cargo cults, which are fascinating for lots of different reasons, but very, you know, Google them. I would encourage everyone to Google cargo cults. But very briefly, what you have are people with primitive technology, relatively primitive technology, who are exposed, like Stone Age level technology, who are exposed to Western or, you know, like modern contemporary technology, you know, for the first time ever. And they interpret this, what to them is like magic, right? They interpret it in terms of their existing mythology. They think, for instance, some of them thought, and this has happened multiple times, but some of them thought that that like the planes that the white men would bring were actually sent from their ancestors, because they were ancestor worshippers, intended for them, but were hijacked by these white men. And you have, you know, many other variations as well. I mean, you know, and I, you know, we, our inclination may be to go and laugh at this, but, you know, this is just a human thing to do, right? We have these background assumptions, and you know, the things that we've learned are plausible. I think I've heard it called a plausibility structure. You know, we have this notion of the things that, yeah, we may not believe them, but they kind of make sense. They're consistent with the stories that we've been told all of our lives. So we're going to tend to jump to those explanations, as strange as they might be, as opposed to any other arbitrary explanation we might come up with. We should be able to see that that's a mistake when we consider how many different plausibility structures there are in different cultures all over the world. So, you know, it, if you think it's silly to go and posit wizards, well, you know, how about djinn? Actually, first of all, with wizards, people do, that is part of many people's plausibility structure all over the world, so it shouldn't be silly to posit wizards. Frankly, a lot of Christians believe in wizards. But if you don't like wizards, how about djinn? For people with an Islamic background, djinn are plausible. You know, I often like to say to Muslims, you know, what makes you think that Muhammad wasn't deceived by a djinn? I mean, you know, why not? I mean, that's something that should be, you know, less counterintuitive to a Muslim than it would be to say and somebody from, you know, the United States or the UK. But it's not reasonable any more than, you know, to speak of elves or fairies would be reasonable, or creators of the universe that have an interest in raising, you know, dead Jewish people back to life. It's not any better. You're just used to it, I would submit.
I agree. And I think it has a lot to do with this matter of intuition. I've heard it said, not rarely, by the way, that a good explanation for the rise of Islam is the work of Satan and his minions. A lot of Christians really believe this. For them, that is just a plausible story. From the Islamic point of view, the opposite may be plausible. I don't talk to a lot of Muslims, but I can't imagine it being too far-fetched for them to say that the rise of Christianity as a distinct religion from what they would consider to be the original teachings of Jesus was somehow influenced by demons or Satan or whatever crazy nonsense they believe in. It isn't more plausible. If we think that it's more intuitive, again, it's just because that's what we've been raised in. That's what our culture has been hammering into us day after day.
Exactly. Even if Jesus actually did come back to life, even if he did raise from the dead, even if you actually had that and you said, no, people really did see a risen Jesus, you still don't have Christianity. And one thing I object to, as I was saying, and I'll quote this exactly, we have that the resurrection is positively relevant to theism on ordinary background evidence should be obvious. To state the matter modestly and slightly loosely, the probability that a God exists is higher if there is significant independent evidence that Jesus rose from the dead than if there is no such evidence. And this is true because the probability that the resurrection took place is virtually nil if there is no God, and higher if there is. On any plausible background assumptions, if Jesus of Nazareth died, then rose again bodily 3 days later, the probability of T is approximately equal to 1, which is to say the probability of theism being true is approximately equal to 1.
That's from McGrew's contribution to the Blackwell Companion to Natural Theology.
Yes, it's on page 594. I want to, the assumption here, and I imagine that probably a lot of atheists would agree, you know, with them in this assessment. I would say, look, even if Jesus rose from the dead, you still don't have the creator of the universe of all things. There's any number of other possible beings. We could imagine aliens, wizards, Q from Star Trek The Next Generation, the nerds who are out there like me. Elves, fairies, you know, all kinds of crazy stories whereby somebody might come back from the dead. You don't get to go right to a creator of the universe. And, you know, it's no more plausible that, under the existence of God, that Jesus would rise from the dead than that he wouldn't rise from the dead. Now, if you specify the God of Christianity, well, yeah, granted, yes, if the Christian God exists, then, you know, we've got a good reason to think that Jesus would rise from the dead. But then that's pretty obvious there. You have all your work ahead of you just to establish that the Christian God exists, that the Christian God is more plausible than any other arbitrary God or condition or state of affairs, such that there is no God that we might come up with.
Yeah, and again, I can't stress this enough. It's like you said, once we once we suppose that the regularities of our universe, of our experience, are not holding like we expect them to hold, as you said, the gloves are off. Anything goes. There's not any, we don't have any reason to prefer one single instance of a violation of natural law over another. There's the whole idea behind preferring one explanation for another is how it fits into our understanding of those regularities. If we don't have the regularities, we don't have a way to prefer one over the other.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
Now, this is a tough thing, I think, because there are so many different ways to come at these apologetic arguments. And I don't know, when I do it, whenever I pick out a particular flaw in an apologetic argument, I can't help but think that by picking out this one flaw, I'm sort of letting all the others slide. And I don't want to do that, because mm-hmm. there really are so many.
Sure.
When I was reading the McRue's piece in Blackwell, one of the things that caught me was that they have all these assumptions, like we said before. One of the assumptions is that the Gospels were written by either eyewitnesses or people who knew eyewitnesses.
Mm-hmm.
Incredibly, they take this to be a fairly straightforward assumption. When I read it, I don't get the impression that they understand that this is extremely controversial and that there's no evidence for it. Except, I guess, if you want to count all the attributions of the early church. The early church thought that these Gospels were written by people named Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the apostles of Jesus, and people who knew the apostles. The problem with that is that all kinds of crazy texts from the ancient Christian world were attributed to the apostles. And, of course, they weren't really written by the apostles. Having an authentic text from the early Christian communities, this was the exception, not the rule.
Yeah.
And
none of the Gospels identify their authors. You know, they're all written anonymously.
As long as you suppose that the titles of the Gospels, the Gospel according to Matthew, for example, as long as you suppose that these were added later, which seems a fairly safe assumption, I don't think Matthew is going to call his Gospel Kata Mateo, or according to Matthew, whatever it is in Greek, we have an anonymous set of Gospels, yeah.
Do any scholars deny that? I didn't think that was controversial, that those titles were added later.
Well, I guess I'm not really acquainted with the scholarship on the titles. I don't know if there are scholars devoted to studying that, or if maybe it's just an offhanded conclusion that they make or what. All I know is that in all of our copies of the Gospels, they have titles with their names on it, as long as they're not fragmentary, in which case they might not have the beginning pages at all. The titles aren't always the same. I mentioned before there's one instance where the Gospel of Matthew is titled simply Kata Mateo, according mm-hmm. to Matthew. And then there's another instance where it's this big, long, grand title that I can't remember because it's so long. So it's not like the titles agree verbatim, but they do all read something to the effect of according to Matthew, according to Mark, according, and so forth.
Okay. Well, in any case, we know that most scholars agree that Matthew and Luke used Mark as a source. So to the extent to which they've lifted material from Mark, well, they're no better than Mark, really. Now, of course, they have additional information in them as well. It's hard to say where that came from. There's no reason to suppose that that's not derivative from, you know, or that they got it from an eyewitness. Mark, there's no indication that Mark was an eyewitness. And so here, there, at the very least, the material they lifted from Mark, that's not, that's not secondhand, that's third hand, right? At the very least, you know, since we're reading it, you know, we have say, Matthew, who is telling us what Mark said, And then, you know, at best, you know, Mark is telling us, you know, perhaps what he saw. But there's no indication that that's the case at all. So, you know, we have some distance here, at least from some of the material. And it's really, there's really no good reason to think that, actually, we have good reason to believe that Matthew especially was making up other material to fit prophecy, you know. And, you know, and you know, if it really was the case that after Jesus died, many of the dead in Jerusalem got up and walked around, you'd think that we have some corroborating there.
Yeah. The Easter zombies, you can't forget that one.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, that should, even if you were to allow for that, you know, the paranormal in history, which we shouldn't, I mean, you would expect that we'd have some additional stories about that. That would be a noteworthy occurrence. And there are other things in Matthew that we could talk about, too.
Sure, but I think the biggest reasons, in my opinion, the biggest reason, the single biggest reason for supposing that the Gospels were not written by the people to whom they're attributed is because, like I said before, authenticity was the exception, not the rule. For example, Thomas didn't really write down the Gospel of Thomas. The Apostle Peter didn't really compose the Gospel which bears his name. The Barnabas didn't really write the second century work called the Epistle of Barnabas. And you can just go on and on listing these examples. You know, the Apostle Paul, he wrote 1st and 2nd Corinthians, we think, but he didn't write 3rd Corinthians. He didn't write the Epistle to the Laodiceans. The forgeries and the false attributions outnumber by far the authentic or potentially authentic texts. With that in mind, skepticism towards the authenticity of the New Testament texts seems to me the appropriate position. And this is not at all helped by the internal evidence. The Gospels, they are contradictory, as I just talked about in the beginning of our podcast. The difference between the portrayal of Jesus in Mark and in John. I think everyone knows about the genealogies.
Luke and Matthew.
Right, in Matthew and Luke. The two different deaths of Judas. And, of course, apologists want to say that we can resolve these contradictions. But, gosh, it sure takes some creative jumping jacks and twists and turns to do that.
That it does. But, you know, however much work, I mean, it's why I think the thing is that they are capable, right, of finding a way to harmonize things. I mean, I used to argue about the inconsistencies in the Bible. I've largely given that up because I've realized that if you're determined to reconcile things, well, you can reconcile anything to anything else. I could go and say that the sky is always and in all respects black, and the statement the sky is not always and in all respects black. Now, I could reconcile those two. All I have to do is to say one was speaking spiritually or metaphorically. I mean, when you can go and play that card, you can make anything fit together. And, you know, that's not all. It's not always as bad as that, but I think that that's often what we have when we have apologists trying to harmonize elements of the scripture. Although, you know, granted, though, not everyone who, you know, argues for the resurrection is an inerrantist, right? I mean, and it's perfectly consistent for an apologist to go and say, look, I'm especially a Catholic apologist, you know, who isn't bound to say that the scriptures are inerrant, but, you know, but rather to say that, look, to the extent to which we have good historical materials here, we can infer that Jesus rose from the dead, Jesus established a church, and the church, you know, gives whatever credibility there is through their, you know, because God is watching over the church, you know, to the Gospels, to the New Testament, and the Old Testament in turn. And so you don't have to be an inerrantist to argue for the truth of Jesus's resurrection and so on, right? We don't want to give the impression that we're only arguing with, with Protestant fundamentalists here.
Oh, no. And this is actually... this is one of the gimmicks that they're using here, which is they're attempting to show that we can use secular tools, secular methods, and a secular historical approach to go and discover theological, religious truths, for example, that Jesus was raised from the dead. And this is exactly what the McGrews are doing. This is what William Lane Craig likes to do in some of his debates. N.T. Wright in his books and materials. Gary Habermas in his debates and materials. It's a very popular approach to try to... take this line of playing by the rules of history and yet still coming up with the results of religious faith. But the problem is that even on this weaker view, you still need the Gospels to be historically reliable, and they're just not. It's not that they're worthless. They're valuable. But they're problematic, and we need to be extremely careful with them. And apologists just aren't willing to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's true enough.
Also, you know, some of their arguments don't really make any sense to me. And just to give an example, from the McGrews, I know the McGrews are kind of our punching bag for today, but just to pick on them a little bit more, they say that the idea of having the women be the first to discover the tomb of Jesus, the empty tomb, they say, is good evidence for this being historically authentic. Why? Well, because if they were making up the story, they would have had men go to the tomb first. And it's not clear to me why this is the case. In their argument, they mention that the testimony of women was not well regarded, that it was suspect and considered unreliable. Not being a historian of ancient Rome, I can't say how true that is, but let's suppose for the sake of argument that it is. It seems plausible enough, I suppose. So let's go ahead and grant that part of their argument. So the testimony of women was not well regarded in antiquity. Fair enough. But how does that connect to the empty tomb story in such a way as to make it more historically reliable? It can't be that it's embarrassing to the early Christians, because there's no reason for them to be embarrassed by this. The resurrection of Jesus does not rest on the testimony of women. In the Gospel of Mark, for instance, Mark ends with the women not saying anything to anyone. In other words, there is no testimony of the women in the Gospel of Mark. The people telling us about the empty tomb, well, it's an angel in the story, and then it's the author of the Gospel of Mark telling that story to us. Mm-hmm. In the other Gospels, it's not the empty tomb that's convincing. It's the appearances of the risen Jesus that convince us that he's the Messiah. Jesus appears to all kinds of people, most notably the 11 leftover apostles, the 11 disciples. Even in the Gospels of Luke and John, the women aren't the only ones to see the empty tomb. Peter goes there. Peter sees the empty tomb. So it's not as if the women are the only ones to see the empty tomb, or that the empty tomb is the only reason to think that Jesus is raised. That's just part of the plot. The reason to think Jesus was raised is that he appeared to all kinds of people. In the epistles of Paul, in 1 Corinthians, he appears to, again, the 12 apostles, I guess Matthias now having replaced Judas. And then he also appears to 500 people at once. This is the reason that people thought Jesus had been raised, not the empty tomb. So it's not embarrassing. But according to the McGrews, it would somehow have been more credible. That's the language that they use. Would have been more credible to have just men having seen the empty tomb rather than both men and women. And that, to me, doesn't make much sense.
That's a really good point. If I could paraphrase your point, it sounds like it's this, that in the Gospel of Mark, we have the women not saying anything. The evidence we have is the angel, what the angel tells the women, and the women go, and they don't report anything to anyone. So that actually would provide an explanation for people not having heard of it, as I, you know, indicated earlier in the podcast. On the other hand, in the other Gospels, well, it's irrelevant that the women were at the tomb, because we have lots of other evidence, you know, in that Jesus appeared to people over and over again. So, you know, it's no embarrassment at all. So you either have something that isn't embarrassing, or you have something where it actually is pretty useful if you don't actually have any further evidence of the resurrection.
That's right. And I don't think the McGrews find it to be embarrassing either. I just want to stress, it's not that. You know, whatever it is, whatever their argument is, it can't be that, because it's not embarrassing. But more than that, it doesn't even make sense to be more credible, which is what the McGrews claim that it is. I don't see why it's more credible to have just men see the empty tomb rather than both men and women, or why it's important that men be present at the first instance of people finding the empty tomb. I just don't see why that's more credible. In the time remaining, I wanted to say a word or two about those very appearances of Jesus that we hear about in the New Testament. The most famous, of course, is that appearance of Jesus to 500 people at once. This is reported by Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. I don't see any reason to take that seriously, though. But however we deal with the appearance stories of Jesus, it is clear to me that a lot of people thought that Jesus had appeared to them. And by a lot, I mean maybe a dozen, or maybe more. But I think the 12 apostles, or the 11 apostles, and Paul, and other people, seem to have claimed that they saw the appearance of the risen Jesus. And the apologetic challenge is, how do we explain these appearance stories? How do we explain the fact that the apostles were willing to really commit to these stories, and that they were willing, in some cases, to die for these stories? Do you have anything to say to that?
Well, unless I'm mistaken, we only have we only have good reason to think that one disciple of Jesus was killed, right? I mean, which would be James the Just, right? Which wasn't, you know, Jesus' brother. Do we have any, I mean, there are traditions saying that many of the other apostles were killed. But we don't have any, you know, good hard evidence of that, do we? For instance, there's a story of Jesus being crucified upside down in Rome, but that's
Peter?
I'm sorry, did I say, yes, Peter, yes, I'm sorry. Peter being crucified upside down in Rome. But that is just a story, right? So I guess I would first go and kind of wonder to what extent we have evidence that they died for their beliefs. But even if they did die for their beliefs, that's pretty cheap, right? Lots of people die for their beliefs, lots of diverse beliefs.
Right.
It's no surprise that people would die for their beliefs.
Yeah, and it's another problem of, there are so many flaws here. Which one do we zoom in on and look at? I think that it's interesting to really take a look at where these martyrdom stories come from. As you say, they seem to come from legendary accounts that are not reliable. Just an example, probably my favorite example, the story of the martyrdom of Thomas. You remember, Doubting Thomas. He didn't believe that that Jesus was risen until he had evidence to that effect. And then once he was given that evidence, Jesus said, "Blessed are those who believe but do not see," right? Glorifying belief in absence of evidence, which seems to me, just as an aside, to be really bad. But this Doubting Thomas was written about in a document now known as the Acts of Thomas. We don't know when it was written, maybe late 2nd century, maybe early 3rd century. But it records the earliest account that I know of of the martyrdom of Thomas. And is this historically reliable? Well, look at the text. Look at what the text relates. In the Acts of Thomas, Thomas is literally the twin brother of Jesus. He is the identical twin of Jesus. And the author of the Acts of Thomas uses this as a plot device. In one memorable anecdote, Thomas attends, he's in India, because he's the apostle to the Indians in this document, and he's attending the wedding banquet of an Indian king's daughter. And he gets up and he gives this speech about how the newlywed couple should devote themselves to God. Well, he's not very convincing, so the couple goes back to the bedchamber and they're about to consummate their marriage. And what do they see? They see what they think is Thomas. And the groom says, "Hey, didn't you leave with the other guests just a moment ago? I thought I saw you leave." And this man standing in their bedchamber says, "It's not Thomas. I'm his brother Jesus." Mm-hmm. And so Jesus proceeds to go and to convince this young couple not to consummate their marriage, using arguments to the effect of children are just good for nothing. They are, for the most part, useless, oppressed as devils. They will get into trouble. They will do evil deeds. They'll get you into trouble. It's best just to stay away from children altogether. Mm-hmm. And so it's, I don't know, do you think that that's historically reliable? I don't know, it seems to me that that's pretty obviously legendary. And I don't think the other martyrdom stories are much better off than that.
So how did Thomas die in the end? How was he martyred?
Oh, he's pierced through with spears by four soldiers sent by this Indian king in the end. He actually says this prayer at the end. And he sees the soldiers coming, and he says, come forward and do what your master has commanded you to do. And they run him through, and that's how he dies. And it's just obvious to me that this is a wild invention. I don't know why we should take it seriously as when we're doing history.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, given the other things that are reported in the story, once again,
sure,
it would be nice to have secular accounts or preferably non-Christian accounts of the martyrdom of the disciples of Jesus. And again, I guess we have one. We have Josephus purportedly, although I guess it's not entirely clear, but purportedly talking about James the Just being killed. But beyond that, we just don't have any account. Although, even with Paul, I mean, you could argue that in Acts it's implied that Paul is killed, although we never, hear that explicitly, right? Or we never read that explicitly.
I don't think it's implied, actually. Yeah. In fact, a lot of apologists say that precisely because it's not in there, this is evidence for it being written before Paul's death. And I don't know, I think that's a horrible argument, but... But it does underscore the fact that Paul's death does not appear in the book of Acts.
Okay, fair enough. But so we really don't have anything even from Christian sources that's credible, much less non-Christian sources, with that one exception of James the Just, perhaps.
That's true. And it's hard to decide what's credible in antiquity. We're blessed with lots of information about the ancient Greek and Roman world, in one sense. But in another sense, we just don't have the handle on it that we have about our own culture and about more modern history.
I would say that we don't even have that great of a handle on modern history or contemporary events. If you've ever been intimately familiar with something that was reported in the newspaper... or if you've ever been cited by a newspaper, you may have had I haven't had many opportunities to be cited, but I was cited by a college paper once, and through no act of malice, just a desire to go and make what was being discussed a bit more interesting. What I said was put out of context and distorted. Didn't make me look bad. It just made it seem like reality was different than it actually was. If you just know, and you know what we may all have, you know, more experience of, in, you know, in the professional press, not just in, you know, in a college paper. If you know something about a subject, and then you, I mean, we really know it well, and then you you read about it in the popular press, you know, if you're like me, you'll say, well, that's not really true. This is, you know, this is off. I mean, the idea that people are generally good at getting the facts right, I just don't think that's true. I think our experience when we're in the know about an event or in a state of affairs in the sciences or what have you, when we know what really happened or what's going on intimately well, and we read just reports of it, we're often really disappointed. So given that that's the case for us today, that gives us all the more reason to really wonder about any kind of report from ancient history. I mean, a lot of times apologists will say, and even this doesn't seem very credible, if you doubt Jesus, if you doubt that he existed and that he rose from the dead, and that, you know, there was an empty tomb at least, and so on, well then, gee, you should be doubting whether or not Caesar crossed the Rubicon, or whether or not Socrates existed. And you know, I to paraphrase Bob Price, who I'm a big fan of, you know, heretic as he is amongst Bible scholars and radical as he is, I think he makes a, you know, this is one among the many good points that he makes. Yeah, that's exactly right. We ought to be reluctant to believe things that are reported in the ancient past, including things about whether or not Caesar crossed the Rubicon or whether or not Socrates existed. It's good to be skeptical of things like that. It isn't to say we don't have better reason to believe that Socrates existed than that Jesus rose from the dead, or that Caesar crossed the Rubicon. That isn't more probable than Jesus having died on the cross. But nonetheless, you know, there could be major distortions about those purported events. I mean, we should be very, very careful with history. So I think that that's true. I think we ought to be, reluctant to believe everything that we read.
Sure. And, you know, I do want to stress that we don't doubt the existence of Jesus, or especially Socrates or Julius Caesar. So we're not radical deniers of the existence of Jesus or anything like that. But, like you said, we should be skeptical. We should be reluctant to swallow whole these rather fantastic, sometimes, stories from the ancient world, and even the not-so-fantastic ones. But in the end, when we decide, well, what is a fantastic story? What is a believable story? One of the problems is we're just going to have to use our subjective judgment. And that's not a terrible thing. I mean, we use our judgment all the time to decide whether people in our present-day experience are lying or telling the truth. That's what we do from day to day. We use our judgment about how people behave and whether or not certain situations, certain people are believable or acceptable. So it's not like we can't use our subjective judgment, but let's be aware that that's what we're using. Let's be aware that when we read these Gospels, we're just trying to use our knowledge about how people behave in order to decide whether or not we should trust them.
Well, if our subjective judgment is going to have any credibility at all, if we're going to have any reason to believe, to trust it, it's going to be because because our judgments are based upon our experience with the way the world actually works, and only to, you know, and again, yeah, we do. We are going to have to make those subjective judgments, but they better be judgments about what's likely to have occurred, given the way the world actually works in our experience today.
Sure, and that's why I would say that the very fact that we're able to get along in the world, I think that this is the reason we have to trust our experiences about, to trust our judgments about how to react to people, how to gauge their reactions, and you know how to make sense of what people do and why they do it. Of course, that breaks down a great deal. People do all kinds of crazy things that I don't know why they. It just defies explanation to me. But that's part of what I know about how people behave. That very uncertainty is part of my picture of how the world works. It's one of the reasons that I'm not troubled by these appearance stories, for instance. I don't know why people would go and claim that they saw the risen Jesus. People do all sorts of bizarre and inexplicable things. That's just the way people are.
Our models of human psychology, while they're valuable, they're they're going to be substantiated on a statistical level. We're going to know what most people do most of the time, but there are going to be exceptions. We don't have a perfect model of human psychology and behavior. And so, we were going to expect odd things to happen when it comes to the behavior of people sometimes.
So, I think we're about out of time, but to our audience, as you're celebrating this Easter Saturday and Sunday, we can think on the resurrection of Jesus as it's depicted in the Gospels. But let's not make the mistake of thinking that it's a historical event. That would be a rather serious violation of the canons of history, as well as of common sense.
Yep, well said. All right, well, goodbye for now then.
Take care, everyone.